going to talk about in these lectures is calculating distributional properties of characteristic polynomials of random matrices and how that can give some insight into distributional properties of the zeta function and other L functions, and links to some very interesting current research along these lines. Now, this first lecture will be entirely elementary. What I'm going to do is to talk about a particular class of random matrices called the circular ensemble, circular unitary ensemble of random matrices. I'm going to do one calculation there just to sort of build up our muscles. So let me remind you what I gather you already know from last week. So I think Jan Fyodorov has given lectures on the Gaussian unitary ensemble. Or GUE. So this concerns matrices which are emission, so that H be n by n emission. So H is equal to the complex conjugate of its transpose, which I'll denote by H dagger. So the dagger denotes complex conjugate of transpose. So H is such a matrix, and one wants to consider a space of such matrices and then apply a probability distribution to that space. And there are various choices one can make for that probability distribution. If you stipulate be invariant under unitary transformations, hence the unitary ensemble. And if you stipulate that the matrix elements modulo Hermitian symmetry are independent of each other, then the natural probability measure that applies is the Gaussian measure. So the probability that you apply to this space of matrices, say P of H dH is A e to the minus B trace H squared dH. The eigenvalues of an emission matrix are real. So they lie on the real line. And one can ask, if one averages over this space of matrices with respect to this probability measure, how these eigenvalues are distributed. And that was the subject of Jan's lectures. But one result which I'd just like to remind you of from there is the joint eigenvalue probability distribution function. I'll call it eigenvalue probability function. Which is the probability of finding eigenvalues at some particular positions. So the probability of finding the first eigenvalue at position E1, the second at position E2, etc. Or rather, within some small range centered on these positions. This is proportional to minus B squared. That comes from the Gaussian measure here. But then there's a Jacobian factor, which tells you that the eigenvalues repel each other quadratically. So the eigenvalues don't like to lie too close together. And then the question is, with respect to this distribution, can one determine particular statistical properties of the eigenvalues? For example, their spacing distribution, their correlation functions. And that's one of the central studies in random matrix theory. So that's a brief reminder of what I'm sure was in Jan's lectures. Now let me introduce another ensemble of random matrices, the ensemble I'll be concentrating on. And this is the circular unitary ensemble. Or CUE. So in this case, rather than dealing with emission matrices, we'll be dealing with unitary matrices. So A will be an n by n unitary matrix. That is A times the complex conjugate of the transpose is the identity. Now we want to consider a space of such matrices. But in this case, there's a rather natural space, which is that we can take these unitary matrices as being representations of elements of the unitary group UN. So we'll be considering, when we average over all n by n unitary matrices, we'll mean by that averaging over the unitary group UN. We have to associate a probability with this in the same way as in the Gaussian case. That is, we have to associate a natural measure with the unitary group, and there is such a measure. There's a measure, a unique measure, which is invariant under action of elements of the unitary group, and this is Haar measure. That is, there's a natural way to weight unitary matrices that's maximally democratic. It's democratic under all symmetries of the unitary group, and that uniquely specifies this measure, Haar measure. I shall give you a formula in a little while. The eigenvalues of unitary matrices are lie on the unit circle, so we can represent them as e to the I theta n, where theta n is real. So this, in the complex plane, the eigenvalues lie on the unit circle in this way. And just as one can ask for statistical information about the distribution of the eigenvalues of random Hermitian matrices, so one can ask about, for the same, statistical information about the distribution of these phases, theta n. So we'll be looking at the distribution of these points on the unit circle. And here distribution means with respect to an average over all n by n unitary matrices. Well, now let me explain a final connection with the Gaussian case. I mentioned there the eigenvalue probability function, where there's a similar formula for the circular unitary ensemble. If we consider functions of unitary matrices, consider particular functions which are functions only of the eigenvalues of those matrices. So in a slight abuse of notation, I'll denote this in the following way. So if you have a function of the matrix which depends only on the eigenvalues and is symmetric in all of the variables, and this is what's called a class function. And all the functions that we'll wish to deal with are of this form. And what we need to know, what we'll need to know in this lecture and in the two subsequent lectures, is how to average such a function over the unitary group. So if we start picking matrices at random from the unitary group, how can one compute averages of functions of this form? Well, the answer was given. The answer is known as Weyl's integration formula. And you find it in Weyl's book in 1946, or thereabouts. And this is a formula which is, plays the role of the joint eigenvalue probability function. So it gives you the probability, essentially, of the associated with the distribution of the eigenphases. So it's the following. If you have a function, a class function, let's say f is a class function, and you want to average it over the unitary group with respect to Haar measure. So you want to average in this maximally democratic way. Then the formula you can use is the following one. F depends on the eigenvalues, or phases theta 1, theta 2, up to theta n. And we'll average with respect to those. From 0 to 2 pi. And the measure you pick up, which plays exactly the same role as the Jacobian factor here, giving you quadratic repulsion, is the following one. It's actually exactly the same factor. And then we have to normalize this, and the normalization factor is that there. So this is the Weyl integration formula, and this will be the basis for everything I say in my lectures. It gives you an explicit way to calculate averages over this particular ensemble, the circular unitary ensemble of random matrices, if you have a function of the eigenvalues. And you find the derivation in Weyl's book. It takes quite a lot of machinery, or you find it in Mater's book, which takes almost no machinery at all, but would not be viewed as an entirely rigorous calculation, but just capture the spirit of it. Essentially, this factor appears in exactly the same way as in the Gaussian ensemble. It appears as a Jacobian of a transformation. And the transformation is that, so the essential ingredients are that, this is just the germ of the idea, Haar measure is, well, first of all, the unitary matrix A can be put into diagonal form by a unitary transformation. So we can change variables when we average over the matrices A. We can change variables to the eigenphases, the phases theta n, and the elements of the unitary matrix which diagonalizes A, and then use the fact that by definition Hahn measures invariant under unitary transformations. So the integrals over the variables representing U drop out trivially because we're averaging over Hahn measure, that's where we're using this particular measure, and then one's just left with an average over the theta n's, and that's the average there. So we use the diagonalization and the fact that Hahn measure is invariant under unitary transformations.
Go on.
Yes?
If this was 1946, before random matrix theory was invented, and this looks like a random matrix formula, what context was Weyl working in? I mean, was he thinking about random matrices?
No, he was thinking about Lie groups and general theory of Lie groups. So he did use this to calculate, but not to calculate the kinds of quantities that would be more traditionally associated with random matrix theory, like correlation functions of the eigenvalues. So that's the Weyl integration formula. Now what I want to do in this first lecture is just to build up our muscles for the circular unitary ensemble to develop some intuition by doing one calculation. A very old calculation that I think was first done by Freeman Dyson in about 1963, and this is to calculate the two-point correlation function of the phases theta n of the eigenvalues of unitary matrices. So the rest of this lecture will be a calculation of the two-point correlation function. Now, I suspect you've already seen in lectures last week calculations of this sort, but they're attractive and it'll pay to see them again. So this is Dyson in 1963. Well, one thing one learns in random matrix theory is that the interesting action takes place, in terms of correlations, on the scale of the mean eigenvalue separation. So when we're looking at correlations, that is how eigenvalues at one point on the unit circle, in this case, know about eigenvalues a certain distance away, one should be looking at distances which scale with the mean spacing. In this case, that's rather straightforward. We want to get the eigenvalues theta n and scale them so they have unit mean density. Well, there are capital N eigenphases, and they lie between 0 and 2 pi, so the scaling factor is... Can you see red on green? No. I saw one head shape, and that could be colour blindness.
Is
that
not colour blindness?
Okay, right. So you just multiply by the size of the matrix n divided by 2 pi, and this gives you a set of quantities phi n, whose mean spacing is 1, in the sense that the theta n's lie between 0 and 2 pi, so the phi n's lie between 0 and n, and there are capital N of them, so their mean spacing is 1. And we'll look at the pair correlation of these scaled eigenphases. So we'll look at the following distribution. We want to sum pairs of eigenphases and pick out those pairs where the separation of scaled eigenphases is exactly the variable x. So we'll put a Dirac, this is a Dirac delta function, this is a distribution We're going to integrate this against test functions a little later. So at the moment, we're picking out with this Dirac delta function pairs of eigenphases whose separation is x. However, we want this to be a function really that's periodic, capture the periodicity of the unit circle. So we'll put in an additional sum over k to make this a periodic function of x, periodic with period n, because of the scaling we've made here. And the natural normalization to take for this is to divide by the size of the matrices. So this is a quantity you can calculate for an individual matrix A. For this matrix, you find its eigenvalues, you scale the phases, and you can calculate this distribution. The question will be how to average this over all unitary matrices, over the unitary group. And this is the calculation I'm going to show you. It's Dyson's calculation. Just to say, for those who are less comfortable with distributions, what this quantity gives you is the following. If you have a sum, I'll put this in parentheses, this is just to keep things tidy for those who are uncomfortable with delta functions. If you have a sum of pairs of eigenphases and you want to calculate the sum of some function which depends just on the differences, then this you get just by integrating that function against this distribution. And we'll put in test functions later, which will be useful. So we want to calculate the average of this two-point correlation function over the unitary group. Natural way to proceed is to recognize that this is periodic in X by construction. And so to calculate the Fourier coefficients, so R2 can also be written as a Fourier series. So the thing is periodic with period n. So we'll have Fourier components like that. And the Fourier coefficients can be worked out straightforwardly. It's an exercise. It's a three-line exercise. That's a representation of R2 as a Fourier series. And what we'll compute is actually the average of the Fourier coefficients over the unitary group. They're the only things that depend on the matrices A. Well, Dyson's theorem can be stated in the following way then. But if you get these Fourier coefficients, and average them, and I'm going to now take it to be understood that I'm referring to Haar measure here, so I'm going to stop writing this little Haar, which is almost certainly unreadable at the back anyway. This can be evaluated to be n squared if k equals 0 mod k if mod k is less than n and n if mod k is greater than or equal to n. So having computed, this is what Dyson tells us, and I'm going to show you how to do this calculation. But having got that, if you know the averages of the Fourier coefficients, we can now get the average of the function of the two-point correlation function R2, its distribution. So now what I'm going to do is to show you how to prove this or sketch an outline. in quite some detail. Yes. 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 He called it the form factor. In physics language, it's called the form factor. That's exactly what this is. He did it this way. Yeah. So k equals zero is very simple, because trace a to the zero is just the identity. So a to the zero is the identity, and the trace of that, trace of the identity is n. So this factor is just n squared. And then the fact that the measure is normalized just means that the answer must be n squared. So this bit... we already have for free. That's correct. Now I'm going to show you how to get the other bits. And for this I'm going to need a little bit of machinery, but it's nice stuff. So I'll do it as it comes. I'm going to need the following lemma, which I'll write in a rather general form because it's useful in many other contexts, not just this one. For f a class function, with the violin integration formula that I've written there. So it's normalized to 1. So if we have a class function and we want to average it over the unitary group, then this is equivalent to the following integral. So I'm going to replace the factor there that's a product over pairs of eigenphases by a determinant, and this determinant is the determinant of the following matrix of the following matrix elements, theta n minus m. So that's a rather general result, and I'm going to prove it in this generality, and then use it to compute the average of the Fourier coefficients. So let me sketch the proof of this. This thing that we want to calculate, the left-hand side here, is by the Weyl integration formula equal to actually, what I'm going to do, just to make writing this a bit easier, I'm going to put all the d thetas in here. Save me having to write them out repeatedly. That's the Weyl integration formula. And now the point is to realize that this factor here can be written in terms of van der Mond determinant. So this is equal to all of this stuff here And then this product can be written as the following determinant. It's the determinant of a product of matrices. In the first matrix, there's ones at the top. Should I leave myself enough room? E to the I theta 1, e to the I theta 2, etc. All the way down to e to the I n minus 1 theta 1, e to the I n minus 1 theta 2, etc. So the determinant of this matrix would just give this factor without the modulus signs and without the square. That's the standard van der Mond formula for a van der Mond determinant. The fact that we have the modulus squared means we can multiply this matrix by its complex conjugate, and if we wish, we can take the transpose, and I shall do that. So the fact that we've got the modulus square means there's another matrix here, and it's this one. So the second matrix is just the complex conjugate of the transpose of the first. Now it's straightforward to multiply these matrices together. So the thing we want to calculate is equal to all of the stuff we had before, and then I'm just going to write the determinant in a slightly different form. So multiplying the two matrices, well, the top left entry is just the all the ones multiplied by all the ones, so I'll write that as sum L is 1 to N of 1, and the next entry is sum L is 1 to N of e to the minus I theta L. And the next entry is sum L is 1 to N e to the minus 2 I theta L, etc. And then below we have sum L is 1 to N of e to the I theta L, sum L is 1 to N of 1, sum L is 1 to N of e to the minus I theta L, etc. That's a simple matrix multiplication. Now you realise that because f, we've not used the fact yet that f is a symmetric function. We're now going to use that fact. So the fact that f is a symmetric function of all its variables means that in the top row here, each term gives the same contribution in the sum. So each corresponding term in the sums gives the same contribution to the overall integral. So we can just pull out the number of terms in the sum, which is n, and take one of the terms. And now we're almost there. So we've just used the fact that the function f is symmetric to say we can just take one term from each of these sums is representative, taking the first one and then multiplying by the number of terms in the sum. Now we can get the, just do a simple transformation of the determinant by getting the first row, multiplying it by e to the I theta 1 and subtracting it from all the subsequent rows. So this is equal to all of the stuff that we had before, and first row stays the same. And now all the subsequent rows will simply subtract out e to the I theta times, or the corresponding power of e to the I theta times the first row, which means that the second row becomes the sum L is 2 to n e to the I theta L, sum L is 2 to n 1, sum L is 2 to n e to the minus I theta L, etc. And all subsequent sums also start with a 2, so you can always subtract out the first term of each sum by subtracting out a suitable multiple of the first row. And now we're home and dry, because now we can play the same trick again, starting with the second row. Starting with the second row, we can use the fact that this integral, the integrand, is a symmetric function of the variables. So we can take out one representative term from these sums, say the theta 2 term, and multiply by the number of terms. But now the number of terms is n minus 1. So you can do this repeatedly for each row, and what you get out is n times n minus 1 times n minus 2 all the way down to 1, which is n factorial. So repeating gives you n factorial. That cancels the n factorial in the denominator before the first integral, and then the theorem's proved, because then the determinant you're left with is precisely the determinant, in the statement of the lemma. So it's just a sequence of elementary repetitions of this step that now give you the lemma. So now we have this, let's use it to calculate the average of these Fourier coefficients. So we want to get the modulus of trace AK squared and average of the unitary group. Well, trace A to the K is clearly a class function. It's a function just of the eigenvalues of A, and it's a symmetric function of those eigenvalues, so we can use this lemma. So let me write out what we're to calculate from the lemma. It's 1 over 2 pi to the n I shall write the modulus square of trace A to the K explicitly in terms of the eigenvalues. P and Q are integers. That's what we're to average, and we're told how to average it by the lemma. We're to multiply by this determinant and integrate over all the thetas. So I'll write out the determinant explicitly. The determinant is 1 minus I theta 1 minus 2 I theta 1 going up to e to the minus n minus 1 I theta 1. That's the first row. The second row is e to the I theta 2, 1, e to the minus I theta 2, going all the way up to e to the minus n minus 2 I theta 2. This goes down to e to the I n minus 1 theta n, e to the I n minus 2 theta n, all the way up to 1. So this is now the integral we're to compute. D theta 1 up to d theta n. So let's look at the terms in this. If we look at the terms where p equals q, so the diagonal terms where p equals q, there are capital N of those diagonal terms, this factor vanishes. And then the fact that the measure is normalized means that this integral is just 1. So if you look at the sum of the diagonal terms, and by diagonal I mean p equals q terms, as I say, there are capital N of them, and each one gives you the value 1. So the answer is N. Now let's have a look at the off-diagonal terms. Well, let's look first of all if k is greater than or equal to n. And we'll look at the off-diagonal terms. If k is greater than or equal to n, we have here in the integrand before the determinant phases theta p and theta q multiplied by a term k which is greater than or equal to n. If we expand the determinant, we're simply going to get combinations of phases again in the same way. So all these integrals are actually rather straightforward. It's the combinatorics that's difficult. The integrals are straightforward. They're simply integrals of phases. And those integrals will vanish unless the phase itself is zero. So we're averaging e to the I j theta from theta between 0 and 2 pi, that's 0 unless the integer multiplying it is itself 0. Well, if you look at the determinant here, the phases theta only ever come with multiples up to n minus 1. So if these phases come multiplied by capital N or more, there's no way they can be cancelled by terms in this determinant, because there simply aren't high enough multiples of the phases to cancel the phase factor here. So in this case, all the off-diagonal terms are zero. And that establishes Dyson's result in this range. Now we just have to ask what happens when k is, say, n minus j. Well, just look at what happens when k is n minus 1. When k is n minus 1, we have all these phases here multiplied by n minus 1. But when you multiply out this determinant, there's only one possibility for getting a factor with an n minus 1 in, and that's where that's from the term in the determinant coming from this element, and the rest are diagonal. Those are the only factors where n minus 1 appears. So the only possibility of getting anything non-zero is if we take the term here corresponding to p is 1, q is n, all the other terms diagonal, so all the other terms equal to each other. So P is 1. The first P is 1. The first Q, for example, is N. All the other terms are diagonal. And we multiply by the term in the expansion of the determinant, coming from multiplying that term by that term and taking the rest as diagonal. So there's only one way to do that. So when J is 1, the off-diagonal term turns out to be minus 1. Minus because this term, when you expand the determinant, the term corresponding to multiplying that by that and taking the rest on the diagonal comes with a minus 1. So when J is 1, the off-diagonal terms give you minus 1. When J equals 2, the possibilities come from, well, there's an N minus 2 here, there's another one here, and there are two down here. So in this case, there are only two possible ways of getting this to be non-zero. And so you get J is minus 2 in this case. And it's straightforward to check that for any J between 1 and N minus 1, the number of terms that you can have which give a non-zero contribution is J, and they all come with a minus sign. So the sum of the off-diagonal terms is minus J. So the fact that the diagonal terms give N means that the total, the final answer is N minus J, and J is N minus K. So this establishes the theorem in the final case. So this is how you, this is a rather elementary way to prove Dyson's theorem. There are far more sophisticated and beautiful ways, but they require far more sophisticated and beautiful machinery. But they're very, very elegant calculations done by a number of people with techniques ranging from representation theory to quantum field theory. All of them give the same answer, thank goodness. So let me now use this. You know, wrap up and use this to, now that we've established the average of the Fourier coefficients, let's calculate the average of the two-point correlation function. Bring this over here. Hence, if we get the two-point correlation function and average over the unitary group, this is just 1 on n squared. This is now the Fourier sum that we have to do. If people over in the corner can see this, but all I'm doing is writing out this again. I'm substituting this into here. This sum is now elementary.
So, you don't have a minus.
Sorry?
Here you don't have a minus in that corner. You have a minus.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thanks. It is actually symmetric in K, so it's not. Thanks. So this sum is now elementary. And you can evaluate it to give the sum J is minus infinity to infinity, delta X minus JN, plus 1 minus sine squared pi X over N squared sine squared pi X over N. So that's how the two-point correlation function looks in closed form for any finite, any n. Now, in random matrix theory, one of the things one learns is that one gets simple limit distributions in the limit of large matrix size. And in this case, one can see that explicitly. We can take the limit as capital N tends to infinity. Let's look at test functions f of x, which tend to zero as mod x tends to infinity. Then if we sum pairs of eigenphases and calculate this function of the differences and ask if this has a limit as capital N tends to infinity. Wrong. Let me write this out again. We're going to get the pair correlation function, and we're going to get the pairs of eigenphases for a particular matrix. Calculate this function of the differences and sum them up. Now we're going to average over the unitary group, so do this for every matrix, and average accordingly. So the term in here is defined for a single matrix. Now we average over all n by n unitary matrices and ask if this has a limit as capital N tends to infinity. You see immediately that it does, because all we have to do is to integrate this function R2, the average of this function R2, against F. Take the limit as n tends to infinity, and this just gives the integral from minus infinity to infinity, f of x, delta of x, plus 1, minus sine squared pi x, over pi squared x squared. So there is a limit distribution, at least as regards pair correlations, but this can be generalized to all endpoint correlation functions in the same way. Let me just give a particular example of a test function that you might choose. So here's a particular example. If we use this as a test function, the indicator function on some specified interval, this will simply count the number of pairs whose separation lies in that interval. So for example, if we count the number of pairs, phi n, phi m, such that phi n minus phi m lies between alpha and beta. We should probably divide by n. So as a particular example of a statistic you might do, you get all possible pairs of eigenphases scaled, and count the number of pairs whose separation lies in some interval from alpha to beta, normalize with the size of the matrix, average over all n by n unitary matrices, and ask if this has a limit as capital N tends to infinity. And what Dyson's theorem tells you is that it does. And we just have to use for f the indicator function on the interval alpha beta, so this is just the integral from alpha to beta, kernel delta of x plus 1 minus sine squared pi x over pi squared x squared dx. And the reason for choosing this is that this is a very natural way to make a connection with the zeros of the zeta function, because in the lecture you've heard from last week from Dan Goldston and perhaps others, there is the famous conjecture of Montgomery, that if you look at the non-trivial zeros of the zeta function, so if we take zeta of a half plus I tn to be zero. And we'll take it to be a non-trivial zero, in which case the Riemann hypothesis implies that all of the TNs are real. And if we define a set of scaled variables WN, which is TN times the mean zero density near the nth zero, then if we get these quantities WN and count the number of pairs of these in some interval from 0 to capital W, such that WN minus WM lies in some interval from alpha to beta. So we're counting pairs of zeros of the zeta function scaled so that they have unit mean density, as I'm sure you've already seen last week, counting the number in some interval from 0 to W. Well, since these have unit mean density, the number of those is about capital W, and ask if that has a limit as W tends to infinity, then of course the Montgomery conjecture is that this is equal to that expression there. So this establishes a connection between zeros of the zeta function and averages over the unitary group, which I'm going to exploit in the next lecture.
Thank you very much. Questions or remarks? Okay, it's lots of information. Let's take this computer again.